and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the West Virginia State Senate today agreed to give striking teachers and all other state employees the 5% raise they had sought, a move that will likely end the walkout, which began on February 22nd. Next, no doubt you know about the infamous Steele dossier written by former British spy Christopher Steele. Well, it turns out there was a second Steele dossier. Meanwhile, the death in London of a Russian ex-spy who worked as a double agent for the UK government has prompted allegations of an assassination attempt. Then, the last four high schools in the working-class Chicago neighborhood of Englewood closed recently, as Mayor Rahm Emanuel's appointed school board responded to gentrification trends. But now, the poor and people of color will have to be bussed out of their neighborhoods to get an education. And then, it's the dirty little secret of Big Pharma. The American taxpayer is funding Big Pharma's research and development primarily through the National Institutes of Health. So where do all those pharmaceutical profits go? Straight into the pockets of corporate leaders and investors. And finally, Thad Cochran, the Republican senior senator from Mississippi, announced yesterday that he is resigning effective April 1st due to ill health. Both of that state's Senate seats will now be up for grabs in November and will pit the establishment right wing against the alt-right. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to West Virginia. The West Virginia State Senate today agreed to give striking teachers and all other state employees the 5% raise they had sought, a move that will likely end the walkout, which began on February 22nd. We're joined from Morgantown, West Virginia, by Travis Booth. He's an organizer with the Morgantown Tenants Union. And we're joined from San Francisco by Frank Lara. He's a member of the executive board of the United Educators of San Francisco. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Travis, let's start with you. This can only be seen as a major victory for those teachers and union members who went on strike and stayed on strike and kept up the pressure on the state Senate and on the governor and others.
And for labor all over the country.
This is a major victory, is it not?
Go ahead, Travis.
Yeah, it's enormous. You know, the feeling on the ground is one of, you know, deep satisfaction at the willingness to stay the course and do what had to be done in order to secure, you know, this victory. The 5% raise was granted by the legislature just earlier this morning from what I was reading. And from what I've been talking with teachers on the ground, like, they're just, you know, in such joy and ecstasy at the fact that they won this. You know, it's never been done like this in 28 years, like we've spoken about before. And it really showed how militancy and united action from working people were able to win the day.
Frank, on this show yesterday, we talked about how the West Virginia teachers were inspiring other people around the country to go on strike, or at least to consider going on strike, or to consider organizing a union. What are you seeing in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Well, first of all, I think it's a huge congratulations to the brave educators who were on the ground and risked really a lot in inspiring the country. It's good to compare the two cases where, you know, this wildcat strike really it's against the law. In some cases, it was even creating tension between the leadership and the base of the union. And contrasting that, I think, with San Francisco, you think it's this progressive, liberal place. You know, there's a lot of union membership. Union leaders really have control over decisions made by both the city and the state. But at the same time, you know, us ourselves, we just finished a contract negotiation where we didn't get close to that initial step and we got a raise. But we're seeing that around the country, the conditions are just so horrible. And on top of that, the political environment does not allow for any type of honest negotiation. And so the West Virginia strike shows that really the moment, the points of struggle aren't where you would think traditionally would be these areas, these strongholds where there's more progressive politics and the unions are more involved. It's actually the places where there's less rights and the conditions are even worse.
Yeah, good point. Right. You know, we were talking earlier about the way the 50s, meaning the reactionary, anti-communist, awful 50s, started to come to an end was not in New York or Berkeley or Washington, D.C. or Chicago. It was in Montgomery, Alabama, where conditions were the harshest, the most repressive. It was a police state, a racist police state. And yet that's where the struggle starts. You never know where things will begin. But obviously, labor has been being beaten back for three decades. And now labor is under attack, and especially the public sector workers, and especially the teachers unions with the Janus case before the Supreme Court, where they're trying to end closed shop, make it illegal. And yet here we are, Travis, West Virginia. This was an, quote, illegal strike. It was a wildcat strike. But it shows that end of the day, working class solidarity and community support and the support from parents, it can overcome these legal prohibitions where, you know, it's not, it's, you know, actually an anti-strike clause, I would say, is unconstitutional because the 13th Amendment says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude can exist in the United States, except as a punishment for a crime, meaning there's still slavery in prisons. But, you know, if you don't have the right to withhold labor, then your labor, if you don't have the right to strike, then it is involuntary servitude. But the teacher said, guess what? No matter what the law says, we have this right. Go ahead, Travis.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, it was such a huge act of defiance, you know, to the political establishment of both the more conservative wings of the Democratic Party and the far right GOP here in the state. You know, to Frank's point earlier, you know, these intense circumstances that people are facing here on the ground really leave people no other option. And I think that's kind of the real lesson to be learned from this action is that, you know, you can't rely on the established political system to back you 100% during every single one of these actions, despite what they nominally might say on the campaign trail or in their public speeches to their supporters and their political base. The teacher really saw through that. And there are a lot of issues within the teachers' movement right now. But the fact that they were able to stay united, you know, regardless of their individual political ideologies and struggle forward in this labor action, really shows the potential and laid the groundwork for future actions. You know, just the other day, the Communication Workers of America just announced that many workers within West Virginia and Virginia were going to be going on strike from Frontier's facilities. So we actually saw this enormous resurgence in labor militancy almost happen instantaneously. Like the spontaneous developments that we're seeing right now are truly inspiring. Yeah, I don't know any other way to put it.
Let me ask Frank. Frank, much was made when this strike was first starting, the West Virginia teacher strike was first starting, because it was illegal, quote unquote illegal, according to the Attorney General of West Virginia. But they went on strike anyway. And I have to agree with both Travis and Brian that this may herald a resurgence in the American labor movement. Are you seeing that kind of militancy where you are, where people are willing not just to go on strike, but to go on strike even when it's illegal or even when they're told that they can't and shouldn't go on strike?
Well, you know, Martin Luther King said that, you know, the arc bends towards justice. And I think that's just the current time. Chicago teacher strike was wildly inspiring, brought in the community. And we saw the same thing in Seattle. We've seen the case here in San Francisco where it wasn't necessary to go on strike, but at the same time, the public is so on our side that we're seeing all these resolutions being passed, and we're even working to get a tax measures to increase the salary of educators. You're seeing a movement to get housing for educators. So I think that the truth is that it's a long time coming. Union and labor militancy has always inspired the mass movements. We're seeing it tied to, obviously, youth fighting against gun control. The current Trump presidency has inspired resistance all over the place. So all of this, I think, is pushing in the direction of really what we're talking about is a class society, issue of economic inequality. And folks are fighting back. So I think we fit within that tradition. It's just important when we discuss it that it all connects. One inspires the other, gives an example from which to build upon. And so definitely in San Francisco, like I said, we've managed to win over the public. And in strengthening the unions, there's nothing wrong with that either, because then you can create influence amongst the political establishment. Then you can build upon the base. And that's important as well. So we both have to show our solidarity. Just recently, last note, our president, Lita Block, set up a handle a GoFundMe page to fund pizza for the West Virginia teachers. And yesterday they arrived and we had over $15,000 in pizza money to give donations. So that type of solidarity is also extremely important.
You know, this strike started after the governor of West Virginia signed into law a bill that gave teachers a 2% increase, and they went on strike. And this has gone back and forth, up and down. There was also increased costs for their insurance, their health insurance. You know, the thing about the outcome of a strike, Travis, is not that the workers necessarily win everything, because rarely do you win everything when you're striking. The thing is whether the workers recognize, one, that a victory, something has been gained that would not have been gained except for the job action of the workers. And that's true for all union struggles. Did the workers' action gain something that was not available before? In other words, the relationship of forces changed because of struggle. That's one measure. And the second measure is whether the kind of struggle that was waged provides a platform or a foundation for an even greater struggle. Do the workers recognize that in this collective action, a victory was achievable, or a victory was achievable, and thus other victories are achievable? That's how the labor movement grew in America. It wasn't because we, the working people of America, won everything at all at once. It's that dialectical dynamic of the struggle itself. 1 minute left, you get the last word. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. By both measures, you know, of whether or not it laid the groundwork for something further and whether or not it changed the framework of forces in the state, this was a success. You know, the ground issue of the insurance program was not fully addressed. It was frozen, meaning there's no longer going to be any increases to the insurance premiums for the next 16 months, according to what I've read. And they're also going to be winning their wages. But it showed the teachers that despite how the political forces might be against them, they have the ability to organize themselves and take action collectively in order to meet their demands. So it was a dress rehearsal, if you will, in staging further actions to solve these issues in the future. You know, so by all measures, this was a success. It really showed the entire community how solidarity wins in the end, and the union is where the action of the people is.
Yeah, and that's I think that's what people are going to look for to the future. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're joined from Morgantown, West Virginia by Travis Booth. He's an organizer with the Morgantown Tenants Union. And we were joined from San Francisco by Frank Lara. He's a member of the executive board of the United Educators of San Francisco. You're listening to The Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
No doubt you know about the infamous Steele dossier written by former British spy Christopher Steele. Well, it turns out there was a second Steele dossier which concluded that it was the Russians who stopped Mitt Romney from becoming Secretary of State. Meanwhile, the death in London of a Russian ex-spy who worked as a double agent for the UK government has prompted allegations of an assassination attempt. We're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Alexander, this is actually, it seems so silly to me that it becomes fun. How in the world could the Russians have been responsible for Mitt Romney not becoming Secretary of State?
Well, the short answer is, of course, that they weren't responsible for Mitt Romney not becoming Secretary of State. The whole concoction is absurd. And it shows how absurd this whole Steele dossier and all the information that has been churning out through Christopher Steele is. The circumstances of Rex Tillerson's appointment as Secretary of State are very well known. It is known that the person who actually proposed him was none other than Condoleezza Rice. The suggestion that, as I said, the Russians had any role in his appointment is ridiculous. And they certainly weren't involved in blocking Mitt Romney's appointment.
Yeah, and it shows, I mean, it's when I saw this headline,
yeah,
I laughed out loud. And I don't know how anyone who reads it couldn't laugh out loud. I mean, obviously, Mitt Romney was trashing Donald Trump. He was like the anybody but Donald Trump movement. And then Donald Trump had him come up to Trump Tower twice, where he was sort of begging to get some appointment in the government. And Trump just strung him along. Oh, my God. So shocking for Donald Trump. It was to humiliate him. Romney, you know, genuflecting before the altar of the Trump organization, said, please bestow upon me the knighthood of Secretary of State. And it didn't happen. But guess what? It was Vladimir Putin. Oh, my God. I mean, it's just, it's like, where does it stop?
Well, I think you put it perfectly. I mean, that's exactly right. The extraordinary thing for me is that though we get all these absurd claims coming out of Christopher Steele, people still seem to put enormous credence in what he says. And one wonders how absurd things have to become before people start to doubt him. His dossier, the famous dossier that was published by BuzzFeed, about which we have heard so much, the FBI has admitted it cannot verify. Anybody who reads it, who's at all familiar, both with the U.S. election of 2016 and with Russian politics, knows that it makes absolutely no sense at all. And yet, as I said, despite that, despite the fact that it cannot be verified, despite this preposterous story about Romney, you still find, as in a 15,000-word article that has just appeared in The New Yorker, attempts to try and build up his credibility.
Let's give credit where credit's due for this bizarre, ridiculous article. That would be by Jane Mayer.
Exactly.
Charles Pierce wrote a piece about it in Esquire, and the headline was, "Would you like some Russia with your Russia?" At what point does circumstantial evidence become something else entirely? Well, yeah, indeed.
Exactly.
I want some Russia with my Russia, John.
And now we have this situation in the UK where this former Russian double agent has taken ill. Perhaps he's been poisoned. His 30-year-old daughter perhaps has also been poisoned. We really don't know yet. The police in the UK are urging caution. They're asking people not to jump to any conclusions, but people are jumping to conclusions.
Well, Boris Johnson.
Yes.
Boris Johnson is threatening sanctions against Russia before any evidence of Russia's links to ex-spy illness. But Alexander, at least over here, the media has already functioned as judge, jury, and executioner. The deal is done. It's obvious that the Russians, in plain view, in plain sight of everyone, Russian intelligence carried out this assassination. Anyway, how does it look over there where you are?
It looks exactly the same over here. If you read the BBC, if you go onto the BBC website, or you read articles by, say, Gideon Rackman in the Financial Times, they take Russian guilt in this case as a given. Now, there is no evidence at all at the moment of Russian guilt, at least that has been made public. The police are carrying out their own investigation. The circumstances of this incident are not at all clear. And I must make the point that this person was in Britain because the Russians released him from prison in Russia, and he was allowed to come to Britain.
But that was so that they could assassinate him on a park bench in London.
It doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. I mean, that's all one can say at the moment, because obviously we don't really have very much information. I mean, to speculate in any way is unwarranted, and to point the finger at the Russian government is not just trebly unwarranted. It is actually preposterous.
Alexander, what would your response be to those who would point to the case of Alexander Litvinenko in 2006? He was exposed to some sort of radioactive, what was it, polonium or something like that, and ended up dying. The British government has maintained all along that this was a Russian assassination. And Brian and I were talking about this earlier today, and Brian called it the weak link in this narrative. How would you respond to that?
Weak link, because people can point back to it and say, well, yes, didn't Russian intelligence actually perhaps, having a falling out with one of their ex-spies, put him down?
Well, the circumstances, first of all, are very different. What little we know about this case does not suggest that this latest attack, if it was an attack — we don't actually know it was an attack — but if it was an attack, was carried out by polonium. Also, this individual who has been involved, who, let us be clear, is not a Russian spy. He is a British spy who was Russian. He was working for the British in Russia. Anyway, he does not seem to have been active politically in the way that Litvinenko was. But last but not least, I actually looked into the Litvinenko case in huge detail, and I have to say that my opinion about it was that there was a compelling case against two people that the British, two Russian people that the British say may have carried out murder. The actual theory of Russian state involvement didn't look to me at all convincing. So, firstly, the parallels are not strong. And secondly, the case of Litvinenko himself having been executed or murdered at the orders of the Russian state, I don't think are very strong either. So I think one must be very careful not to jump to conclusions based on very insecure foundations.
And it's interesting also that Marina Litvinenko, the wife of the man who died from the polonium poisoning, she said about this case, "It looks similar to what happened to my husband, but we need more information. We need to know the substance. Was it radioactive? We don't have enough information about what definitely happened. I cannot say I am worried, but it is really strange. But I need to know what has happened and why. Logically, it's a very strange thing to do this before a presidential election. It's really difficult to know who might be behind this." So here's the widow, and she's saying, well, why would Russia do this on the eve of the Russian election to assassinate this man that Russia had released from Russian jail, someone who was a British spy and then released from Russia? Why would they assassinate him in public view? And again, it doesn't matter to the likes of Boris Johnson, who's already saying maybe the Britain won't participate in the World Cup in Moscow. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said, "We don't possess any information about what could have been the cause for his illness and what it's connected to." He also added that Russia has no contact with the UK over the incident, but, quote, "Moscow is always open to cooperation." I don't think that's coming through, Alexander, that Russia is actually suggesting and proposing to the British law enforcement they're willing to work with Britain to find out what might have happened here. That's important.
It's not coming through at all. If we go back to what Maria Litvinenko says, I mean, she says extremely sensible and proper things. We don't have any evidence, as I said, as of this time, that the Russians were involved. As you absolutely rightly say, the timing seems very strange, not just before, not just given that it's immediately before the presidential election in Russia, but also given that the World Cup is a few weeks away. And can I just say, Boris Johnson actually drew back on the suggestion that England might boycott the World Cup. He's now saying that the only thing that might happen is that politicians and diplomatic representatives from Britain might not attend the World Cup. So he's already watered that down.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Britain's Boris Johnson says UK involvement at World Cup in Russia may not, quote, go ahead in the normal way.
He's very typical of Boris Johnson, actually. I mean, he makes a dramatic statement, which he then speaks to his officials and they tell him, you know, that's nonsense. We can't really do that. And then, of course, he draws back. One should never, I'm afraid, pay very much attention to the things he says, because they're likely to be contradicted within a few hours.
We have a politician in the United States who, I don't know, similar track record.
Guys, there. I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The last four high schools in the working-class Chicago neighborhood of Englewood closed recently as Mayor Rahm Emanuel's appointed school board responded to gentrification trends. But now the poor and people of color will have to be bussed out of their neighborhoods to get an education. We're joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola. He's an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Kofi, welcome back.
Thank you all for having me.
Kofi, there are a lot of large cities in this country that go through gentrification, but they don't close their schools down. Why is Chicago different?
That is a good question. it seems like it's a very elaborate plan that has been in the works since Mayor Daley, and it seems like Rahm is just sort of full steam ahead with the plan. We know that he closed over 50 schools in 2013, right? But prior to that, we saw predominantly Black neighborhoods, and specifically neighborhoods with the projects still up, like Cabrini Green, like Stateway, Augil Gardens, et cetera. Those got immediately revamped, demolished, and then the community pushed out, and developers came in, popped up the Starbucks, popped up the condos. Completely different, transformed community. So now what we're seeing is with some of the schools that get closed down in 2013, right, is developers are actually looking to come in and purchase those, either turn them into gyms, right, or turn them into property for people to move in or office. And these are in the same communities where predominantly Black and brown people live, but you see evictions starting to happen. Rahm also raised the property tax for folks. We don't have rent control in Illinois. So it seems like we're getting attacked from all angles to push Black people out. I think over a five-year span, over 200,000 people have left so far, right? And it's predominantly poor people being pushed out. And not just the Black community and the Latinx community, too. We have Little Village in Pilsen in back of the yard. They're being pushed out of their communities, too, right? So we definitely have to examine it through the lens that this is, you know, a greater scheme to continuously attack poor people, but specifically Black and brown people, and, you know, marginalize them and push them out, because we live near the expressways on the south side and west side. We live near, you know, where industry used to be. So now we see this sort of reversal where people, you know, the white flight that happened during redlining in the 50s and 60s, where they fled out to the suburbs, now they're trying to basically come back, and this is what we're seeing as a result of that.
Kofi, the other rationale, in addition to the gentrification and thus the deterioration, or I would say murder of public education in Black communities, and trying to evict people from their homes and their neighborhoods, making life, in essence, sort of unlivable by one means or another. A second rationale for closing these schools, at least from some of the progressive people I've spoken to in Chicago, is part of a broad effort to weaken one of the strongest teachers unions in the country. The Chicago Teachers Union Local, they showed by their struggle both in the 2012 strike and the 2015-16 contract negotiations, which obviously those events loom large over decision makers at City Hall. This union, which is also a largely black-led union, has been in the forefront of public sector and teacher union struggles, not just in Chicago, not just in Illinois, but around the country. Do you see it that way as well?
Absolutely. I was in the streets with them back in 2012. I was in the streets with them trying to prevent the school closures. They've been supportive of the movement for Black Lives. There's a lot of intersection between work, you know, fighting for workers' rights, unions, Fight for 15, Chicago Teachers Union, et cetera, right? Because we're all trying to push back at the intersections of where we are being, you know, evicted, you know, giving low wages. They're trying to break up the unions. You know, we have Governor Rauner and Rahm Emanuel, both our mayor and our governor, essentially attacking the CTU at every opportunity they get to destabilize them and to, like you said, absolutely attack one of the strongest unions in the country, because that sends a message loud and clear that your work and labor is only supposed to be exploited at the expense of the bosses, and you have no stability, and unions protect us. So if you can destabilize that, then you essentially have all the power of negotiation or the power of, you know, making sure that your profit margins always have priority over people. So absolutely.
And let's talk about the governor for a moment and the other contenders for the office. Bruce Rauner, who Kofi just mentioned, he's a billionaire,
mm-hmm.
and he has a charter school of his own, as does the gubernatorial frontrunner J.B. Pritzker, another billionaire.
Who has the backing of the Democratic Party, by the way?
So you see this, it's a bipartisan effort. So we can trace, though, that the Trump administration, but before that, the Obama administration, but Trump, especially now with Betsy DeVos, whose main goal in life as Secretary of Education is to destroy public education and privatize education. But a lot of that momentum was already begun under President Obama. And again, coming from Chicago to a large extent, this is a project of the elites, of the neoliberal capitalist elites, except now it's on steroids with Betsy DeVos. Kofi, I mean, Chicago might be sort of the petri dish for this because it's a big city. It's a multinational, multi-ethnic, multiracial city. It has a huge, strong black community. If the right-wing privatizers can get away with it in Chicago, they probably feel, well, we could get away with it anywhere. In other words, this might be the epicenter of the nationwide struggle. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I would say we can look at New Orleans after the tragedy of Katrina, right? Public education was decimated under the Bush administration. And, you know, the privatization of education came strongly along with pushing out, you know, its original native residents, right? We can look at what Betsy DeVos did in Michigan and decimating public education there. So, you know, that is definitely something we have to take into consideration. We have to see all the players and, you know, what politics they're bringing into it. And just another strong correlation, again, you know, just back to Rahm, is that the priority over police, over education. You know, our police budget is over 40% of the budget. They get $4 million a day. And that's not including the extra $65 million that police rack up in overtime.
Those are amazing numbers.
Terrible.
Yeah, the $100 million that the city pays for civil cases because of police brutality. Mm-hmm. He's also trying to build a $95 million cop academy in West Garfield that has some of the highest rates of unemployment, intercommunal violence and things of that nature, instead of investing into education, trauma centers, mental health care. So we see this policy shift and continuously seeing more legislation to criminalize black and brown folks while simultaneously destroying educational opportunities. And we know that the bigger goal is the shrinking of the common good, the public wealth, right? And the absolute privatization of every aspect, including, you know, cutting social services and, you know, just everything is under attack right now. And we have to be very leery of this.
Kofi, you said something earlier, too, that I want to bring up again because it's so important. You said that instead of just shutting down these high schools, these four high schools, and replacing them with this, whatever it is, $85 million, $95 million new high school, that they could keep at least some of those schools or one of those schools and turn it into a community center. We know for a fact, thanks to the city of Los Angeles, that that actually works. Keeping a building open where children can gather after school, they can play basketball, they can learn how to play an instrument, they can hang out with their friends and play pinball or cards or whatever. Someplace safe where they're not on the street, making trouble or getting into trouble, or being influenced wrongly. We know that the very little money that's spent on that kind of an activity or an organization dramatically cuts down on crime in high crime neighborhoods. So why in the world is Rahm Emanuel ignoring that and instead funneling yet more money into the police? We've got 1 minute left. Go ahead.
I think because that's part of the grand scheme. I think when you push a narrative of criminalizing folks, when you push a narrative of, you know, people being a blight on the community and you demonize that community, it makes it easier for you then to set up the zoning how you want, to set up, you know, to get developers in, to raise the rent, to raise property tax, to push people out. You destroy the schools, people have to go. So if your goal is either to incarcerate folks or if your goal is either to displace and push people away, then that's what you do. You invest so, you know, a lot into policing, you destroy any public good like any social services or, you know, educational institutions.
Yeah. A problem that...
It's a war. It's a war against working class, poor, and black and brown communities.
That's right. And the money's there. It's just being spent on the wrong things. We're going to have to leave it there, Kofi. We were joined from Chicago by Kofi Adamola, an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's the dirty little secret of Big Pharma. The American taxpayer is funding Big Pharma's research and development primarily through the National Institutes of Health. So where do all those pharmaceutical profits go? Straight into the pockets of corporate leaders and investors. There's a new study out by the Center for Integration of Science and Industry that we'll dive into today. We're joined from New York by Bryn Gay. She is the Hepatitis C Virus Project Coordinator at Treatment Action Group. And she has previous policy and advocacy experience with the United Nations, Doctors of the World, and the North-South Institute, focusing on affordable access to medicines. Bryn, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We've seen this report. It was published at portside.org, and it says that Big Pharma, with its massive R&D budget, doesn't actually spend that money on R&D. It spends it on marketing. And in fact, the R&D is done at taxpayers' expense, primarily through the National Institutes of Health. Is this something new, or has Big Pharma been pulling the wool over our eyes for a while now?
Well, thank you for looking at this study. I mean, this is another sort of example of how Americans are being scammed, and that we continue to let Big Pharma scam us. I think that this research is really important in terms of, you know, bolstering our arguments against some of these myths that they continue to perpetuate. I mean, this study itself is showing how the National Institutes of Health have funded about $100 billion in research and development, and like 90% of that is going into basic science. So, and out of that, something like 84, like first in line new drugs have come out of that. And some of them include like HIV and hepatitis C medicines. So we're seeing how, you know, NIH is bankrolling a lot of the essential research and development and are taking sort of the more riskier side of drug development. And yet we allow for companies to come in and acquire through mergers and acquisitions, acquire biomedical firms, like in the case of Gilead acquiring Pharmasset, which developed Sovaldi or Sovosavir, which is used to treat hepatitis C. And you know, they come in and they acquire this, and then they're able to put, you know, the final, you know, sort of touches, go take the drug through development, through, you know, the Food and Drug Administration approval processes, and then put them under patent and lock them away at prices that are way out of reach for most patients in this country. So I think this is just another exemplary sort of case. This is sort of just helping to bolster our arguments that we need to push back against these pharmaceutical lies that that they are putting a lot of their profits into research and development. This is simply not true.
We pay more for medicine and pay more for healthcare services than any other, certainly any other advanced industrial country in the world. And at the same time, we don't have good healthcare. We have lousy healthcare in many ways. And now the reason this story is important is that the mantra from the pharmaceutical companies is that they have to jack up these prices.
Right.
And the FDA gives them patents and exclusivities for, I think it's 17 years for a drug, meaning that they have a monopoly on pricing. But they have to have this high pricing because they spend so much money in developing these wonderful drugs. And that money is their research and development. And only if the drug at the end of the day, where the gold pot at the end of the rainbow materializes, because so many drugs don't work out, because there's so much R&D for drugs that actually fail, that it's justified. That's the main
Sure.
rationale. But what this study seems to be suggesting is that that's BS, bad sociology, or however we want to characterize that, that it's just it's propaganda.
Yeah. In fact, the study says that most of the money, most of the profits go to executive bonuses, share buybacks, lavish mass marketing campaigns to increase the sales of things like amphetamines, for example, or opioids. That's where the money goes. The money's not going to real R&D, at least not the company's money. They're using that taxpayer money. Go ahead, Bryn.
Right. And I mean, this is kind of outrageous that, you know, this in a very hyper-capitalist country like the United States, that we allow sort of like free riders, like pharmaceutical companies, to claim rewards through the patent system. So I find this really outrageous, mind-boggling that we kind of allow for this. On the one hand, we say, you know, we need to be rewarding this. At the same time, like these companies are showing that they really haven't been doing the riskier side of it and the harder aspects of drug development. The NIH is funding this. And they're subsidizing that research. And then we are paying for this twice, that we're then through the Medicaid, Medicare, the Veterans Administration, that we're then having to pay for these drugs again. So, I just don't think that this is viable. I think that we need to continue to arm ourselves with these arguments, that this is just unacceptable, and that we cannot allow for this broken system to perpetuate. And as you say, most of this sort of the profits that have been generated, like for instance, you know, hepatitis C drugs have generated something like $70 billion since the direct acting antivirals hit the market in 2014. And with that $70 billion, you would think, oh, well, we're going to be seeing, preventative vaccines soon. Yet we're seeing like companies like Gilead and Janssen have walked out of the hepatitis C market. So they're not interested in developing preventive vaccines, and they're not interested in continuing research in the hepatitis C field. So we can't let pharmaceutical companies also set the research and development agenda, because we're never going to see any sort of drugs come to fruition for neglected and infectious diseases.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I actually knew a guy who was in prison for, it was like burglary or robbery or something, and he had contracted hepatitis C. And the Bureau of Prisons is compelled to treat him because he's under their care. But the treatment was so expensive, as you pointed out, Bryn, a couple of minutes ago, the treatment was so expensive that they actually released him from prison rather than to pay for his hepatitis C medications. In my own case, I was complaining to Brian just recently. You know, it's the start of the new year. I happen to have diabetes. I went to the CVS to pick up my medication, and it was $1,500. So I either go without medication or try to get that medication through Canada so I don't have to pay these mafia gouging prices that are big pharma companies charge.
You mentioned mafia because this seems like organized crime. And, you know, the right wing in America always talks about we have to get big government off of our backs, but they seem to be perfectly content. When I say the right wing, I mean from both parties, actually. They seem to be perfectly content with the pharmaceutical companies in conjunction with the FDA basically taking America prisoner. Bryn, why are medical pharmaceutical prices so much less in Canada or Mexico?
Well, and this is a great question. I mean, I think that one aspect is that we have a very fragmented healthcare system, right? So we have four big payers. You mentioned one of them, which is a Bureau of Prisons, and each state has their own budget in terms of how they cover certain treatments through the prison system. But we have such a fragmented system, and I think if we look at countries that have sort of a national public health care, some countries like Germany, India, they're able to set sort of price controls. And I think this is one of the issues that we could be thinking about, is allowing for government to set sort of price, having regulations on pricing. This is a bipartisan issue. We're in a mid-year elections period. We need to be thinking about this and holding our elected officials accountable for these extortionate drug prices. We need to understand that about 3/4 of Americans have said that we need government intervention on drug prices. One way to do that is, having Medicare Part D to negotiate. This has resounding support for something like this. And I think that, if we look at Germany, there's a system called AMNOG. It's the Act to Reorganize Pharmaceuticals Markets. They allow for the regulation of prices, and they allow for companies to set the price for the first year, and then the drugs are assessed under an independent review mechanism, and they sort of determines if they're allowed to continue to pay and be remunerated at that list price, or if they can diminish and decrease over time. So I think there are other options out there, and I think price controls are one of them. I also think that, perhaps putting a moratorium on medicines, a moratorium on patents on medicines, a moratorium on patents on health technologies, getting patents off of medicines completely, and allowing for medicines to be seen as public goods and kept affordable in the public domain is going to be the most effective solution to addressing drug prices.
That's an excellent point.
It's really the bottom line of this whole thing.
I mean, why should these monopolies? And they are monopolies, right, Brennan?
You brought up the mafia. Exactly. It's a cartel.
You say something in this article that I think is so important. You use Gilead as an example where they developed this drug for hepatitis C. A 12-week treatment course cost them $100 to produce, or just under $100 to produce. But they are charging six figures for it, over $100,000 to produce it. At the same time, they've raked in profits of over $70 billion, and that $70 billion does not go to additional research and development. It goes to shoring up the share price.
Right. And we're also seeing tax loopholes, tax cuts. So a lot of this revenue we're seeing is being parked offshore. And so, I mean, again, we're not even getting sort of compensated back to the NIH, for instance. We're allowing companies to just park this revenue offshore. And so this is a whole other sort of issue that we need to be tackling. But as I said, I think that, you know, we can look at delinkage, which is what is the actual cost of producing this medicine. So Andrew Hill and his team developed research that shows that, you know, the hepatitis C medicines are able to be produced. The supply chain of that is $100, including a 10% profit margin. It includes sort of what you would pay for taxes at like a 20% tax rate. So, I mean, we are being completely scammed. We need to be continuing to call this out. And you know, we need to ensure that the NIH is continually funded, since they are the ones that are actually getting drugs from bench to bedside.
Yeah. John, what we're hearing now from Brin is really, it can only be characterized as looting on a grand scale.
That's right. And every American is a victim. We're out of time, though. We were joined from New York City by Brin Gay. She is the Hepatitis C Virus Project co-director at Treatment Action Group, and she has previous policy and advocacy experience with the United Nations, with Doctors of the World, and the North-South Institute, focusing on affordable access to medicines. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Thad Cochran, the Republican senior senator from Mississippi, announced yesterday that he is resigning effective April 1st due to ill health. Both of that state's Senate seats will now be up for grabs in November and will pit the establishment right wing against the alt-right wing. We're joined from Washington by Jim Jatras. He's a political analyst, a former U.S. diplomat, and a former senior foreign policy advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. Jim, welcome back.
Hi, John. Hi, Brian. How are you doing? Glad to be here.
Jim, this had to be the last thing that Mitch McConnell was looking forward to in the run-up to this election. Mississippi, though, is a very Republican state, so the real battle is going to be within the Republican Party. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, of course, as you mentioned in the introduction, that there already is a Senate race in Mississippi this year. Incumbent Senator Roger Wicker is up for re-election in his normal Senate rotation term, but now this will mean another special election to serve out Senator Cochran's term. So we'll have two races going on at the same time. Right now, there is a challenger to Senator Wicker, State Senator Chris McDaniel, who is, again, you know, if you accept what you see in the media, is of the Bannon populist wing of the party. And there's some talk that he may switch his campaign now from challenging Wicker to running for that special Senate election seat that is caused by Cochran's vacating it.
Well, it seems that would take a lot of pressure off of the Republican Party there. And the Washington Post yesterday said that there's speculation that Mike Espy, who was the first Black Democrat elected to Congress from Mississippi, is considering running for the Democratic nomination. Do you think that if the state senator were to move over to the race, to join the race to replace Cochran and then leave Wicker alone, that would sort of preserve both of those seats for the Republicans?
Well, I think it would be good news for Wicker. I think you'll still have a big fight, though, for Cochran's seat. And the reason why is that the governor, Phil Bryant, is going to appoint somebody to fill that seat in the interim. And I assume that somebody is still going to run for the seat, as well as McDaniel, maybe several other people. So I think what the Democrats could be hoping for is you get a split within the Republican Party, somebody nominated then who might not be as strong. Well, of course, the case here would be what happened in Alabama. So they would hope that somebody would end up as the Republican nominee who could not hold the seat.
I'm looking at a piece today in the Conservative Review magazine, and it's entitled Three Reasons Thad Cochran's Resignation is a bigger Deal Than You Think. And this is they make some points that I think are easy to forget. Number one, Thad Cochran has been around for a long time, and he's actually second in seniority behind President Pro Tem Orrin Hatch. And Hatch is also moving on. The next Republican on that list is Chuck Grassley, who was elected to the Senate in 1980. But second, Cochran is the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, arguably the most powerful, most important committee on Capitol Hill. And as you pointed out rightly, I believe, Jim, it alters the GOP primary calculus in Mississippi. So let's say that there's a scenario like what we saw in Alabama when Jeff Sessions resigned and a mainstream establishment Republican was named to replace him. We already know that State Senator McDaniel is interested in running. He ran against Cochran a couple of years ago and nearly beat him. So what do you think the chances are that this fight between the establishment and the more conservative right wing within the party is going to come to a head again? Do you think that McDaniel can actually win a primary against Wicker? Or do you think that McDaniel could win against whoever it is that the governor appoints to replace Cochran?
Yeah, I think it could. And obviously that kind of bloodbath inside the Republican Party is what the Democrats would pin their hopes on. But I would caution them against being too hopeful. Let's remember that what really brought the Democrats to win an unprecedented Senate seat in Alabama for you know, decades was the fact that the eventual nominee wasn't so much that he was a populist or a challenger to the establishment, but because he was Roy Moore, who happened to have some other baggage that had dogged him in the past. I don't know that that's necessarily going to be true of McDaniel unless something pops up that we don't know about at the moment. The simple fact that he's of the more populist, you might say, Bannonite wing of the party doesn't necessarily bode ill for the Republicans in the state. They could end up very well electing two senators, Wicker, who tends more toward the establishment wing, and McDaniel, if he is the nominee, who's more of the populist wing, but they still win both of them.
Yeah, the Washington Post says something that I think is important and that we ought to note. It says, no one is suggesting that Cochran's seat is in danger of going to a Democrat. Mississippi hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate in nearly 30 years, and Republican Donald Trump easily won the state in the 2016 presidential race. Is there any scenario by which the Democrats could win? Because you're exactly right. We're not talking about Roy Moore here. We're not talking about McDaniel, State Senator McDaniel, being accused of any kind of crime. He's just very conservative.
Exactly right. And again, what you just said about the Democrats not really having a chance in Mississippi was exactly what they said about Alabama until Roy Moore was the nominee. And then all of the stuff about the women came out of the woodwork. If there is something in anybody's closet we don't know about, it could be McDaniel, it could be somebody else who wins the primary for Cochran seat. Yeah, that lightning could strike. I don't necessarily expect it to. And so I don't think the odds for the Democrats are that good, even though let's stipulate that everybody on that side is expecting, well, there's going to be a big anti-Trump vote. They're going to get their troops out to the polls in November, and it's not clear yet whether the Republicans can do so.
So let's talk about the broader politics of the country. The Democrats have to defend an inordinately large number of seats this year. Of course, one third of the Senate is up for re-election. And the projections are, regardless of what happens to the Republicans in the House of Representatives, the projections are that the Republicans could either hold the line in the Senate or pick up a seat or two. What do you think about the Republicans' chances of increasing their Senate majority?
Oh, I think that expectation is just about right. I think, you know, you do have the problem with several senators. You think of, I'm trying to remember, West Virginia.
Manchin,
yes. And several other people who are up in very heavily states that Trump won very heavily during the 2016 election, if any of those in danger. But I think an even split or maybe even one or two pickup by the Republicans is quite possible. The real action really is the House. If the House goes Democrat, I have no doubt whatsoever that Trump will be impeached And if that happens, that he would be removed.
You know, we've spoken on the show a couple of times about these generic polls. Just would you vote for a Democrat or would you vote for a Republican if the election were held today? And I'm looking at realclearpolitics.com, which is just a fantastic source of polls. It's sort of an aggregator of polls. And it's showing, for example, yesterday, Democrats by 15, Democrats by 6, Democrats by 9, Democrats by 16, Democrats by 7. Anything over something like 5% is considered a wave election. They're projecting something like a tsunami election. So it looks like the House will go Democrat, could go Democrat. With that said, political observers are saying that the same cannot be said about the Senate, that it will likely remain Republican. Now, to your point that Democrats in the House will initiate impeachment proceedings, in the event that that happens, let's say that they do vote to impeach Donald Trump for whatever reason. The man hasn't been accused of any specific crime, but let's say that it happens. It'll, of course, be bottled up in the Senate. But then what does that do to the Democrats in terms of PR, where instead of tackling the important issues of the day, healthcare, education, whatever, they focus on Donald Trump? Do you think then that the Republicans could use that as a way to try to win the House back again in 2 years?
I disagree with your premise that it would be bottled up in the Senate. First off, as I say, I think if the Democrats do take the House, and I don't take it for granted that they will, a numerical way based on party preference is not the same. You know, generic poll is not the same as an election in a specific district where you're dealing with individual candidates. There are no generic candidates on the ballot ever. So I'm not sure it doesn't necessarily means that the House will go Democratic. But as I say, if he's impeached, I think even if the Republicans control the Senate, he will still be removed. And the reason I think that is, unlike the Democrats who rallied around their president when he was Bill Clinton, when he was impeached, there's anywhere between, I would say, a quarter and a third of Republican senators who would be jumping at the chance to cut Donald Trump's throat. They may be going along with him now while he's president, but when the time comes, they will not rally around him the way the Democrats did around Clinton.
Wow. Well, we were joined from Washington by Jim Jatras. He's a political analyst, a former U.S. diplomat, and a former senior foreign policy advisor to the U.S. Republican leadership. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. And you can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.